We're ready to go.
It's 5:29, man. We got a minute.
We got another minute?
Matt's gonna go to Clark.
Well, she's.
Well, be.
Okay, good evening, Planning Commission members. We are going to go ahead and get started. But before we get started, I would like to welcome our newest member and have him introduce himself. That's Brian, that the council appointed as a new Planning Commission member. So I'll let Brian introduce himself. Then I'll come back and introduce Mike, who is our newest staff. So, Brian, you have the floor, sir.
All right. The mic is on, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you, Oliver. As Oliver said, my name is Brian Dinge. And I've been in Clark County on and off for the past 12 years. Kids that went to high school here, graduated from high school here. I have one attending WSU. So I have a lot of interest in terms of what's going on in Clark County, and so I'm excited to the appointment by the county councilors, and I'm looking to be able to assist the Planning Commission and Clark County and Oliver.
Thank you.
Marcia. So welcome. Thank you. And if I can have Mike stand up. Mike is our newest staff to community planning, and we are happy to have Mike. And also, he's a double-double. He's not only working for community planning, he's also working for public works and also reports to Rob and reports to my shop. So he's in demand. Let me put it that way. So welcome, Mike. So with that, today is going to be more informational work session with the Planning Commission. There is no hearing item coming before you this month. So this is more of an informational work session with the Planning Commission. Before we also started, I did talk to Mr. Ron Barker. He indicated that he should be excused tonight. So I'm just letting you know that he did inform me he will not be here tonight for family matters. With that, I'll turn it over to Jose with the first item.
Thank you, Oliver. Jose Alvarez. The buildable lands update is a project that we have started. I think we came to the Planning Commission in July with Bob Poole to kind of give you an overview of the vacant buildable lands model. I know Brian and Bryant haven't seen that, so maybe we can make some time to sit down and go through that with you guys for about an hour or so. Just to give you some context overview of this project, here's a timeline essentially for the next periodic plan update. That has to be done by the June 30th of 2024. This buildable lands analysis is a requirement by the state to sort of monitor our plan and sort of evaluate the planning assumptions and densities to see how we're growing and see if we have enough capacity to accommodate the population that's left in the time horizon. And then that sort of starts us off on the next comprehensive plan update after we get this population number from OFM. But this buildable lands report has to be completed by June 30th of 2021. So we have begun this process last year. We hired a consultant in September, October, Eco Northwest. We had our, we have a advisory committee made up of 14 members from the community. Two of those are from the Planning Commission, Mr. Swindell and Mr. Barca. We had our first meeting December 6th, and we sort of went over some of the items that we thought need to be addressed, and I'll go over those kind of briefly. So in December, we had a meeting with the advisory committee. We went over some of the issues we thought we need to tackle. There were some guideline updates that we were really focusing on, and also some seeing if we can do some things with the model a little bit better, just given the data that we've collected and what we've seen over time. Can we refine this to make it a little more accurate? And so those are some of the things that we're going to be working on. So we had the first meeting this December 6th. This is going to run through September, and it's broken up into sort of different topics, identifying land suitable for development. There's land classifications, redevelopment we're looking at in our next meeting, which is tomorrow. Between those meetings, we had a work session with the county council the end of January to kind of refine and essentially the tasks that the committee are led out to do. We got some feedback, and so we added, I think, one item related to the capacity, the rural capacity estimates, and then a couple of refinements that we added from the first meeting we had with the committee. So kind of this is the list of those topics and the meeting dates and kind of the schedule. We're supposed to have a recommendation from the advisory committee September 2020. We'll take that to council for their briefing and direction, and they give us the go-ahead. We'll sort of update the model and then run it through the Type 4 process, and so you'll see that probably February 2021, spring time, somewhere in there. And so you'll get to see the report and all of the stuff that goes into it. Having two of your fellow members on the committee, they can provide you updates as we go along, and I'd be glad to come back and share those updates with you as well as needed, to just to keep you up to date on what's going on. Do you have any questions at this point?
The only thing I will add is that the buildable land model often serves as the foundation for the update to, or the periodic update to the comprehensive plan, because we use this to establish what is the existing capacity, and from there whether we need to expand the boundary and then by how much, given the decision that the council have made relative to population and jobs. So it is the foundation that helps us, not only the county, but all the seven or eight cities that we plan with. So we have to agree on what the capacity is, and we use this model and tool to help us get there. So it's really essential that the Planning Commission familiarize yourself with the model and the outcome. So that's the only thing I would add.
Jose, will you reach out to Bryant and myself?
Sure, I can do that.
Set something up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
glad to do it.
Okay, I will do that. You want to go?
Chuck, you want me to go next?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Jackie and Jose. This will be a joint effort. The 2020, before I start, the Planning Commission is aware that we are one of the departments that the council approves our work program every year. The county used to do a two-year budget, and as such, our work program used to be 2 years. Now the county have gone to a one-year budget, so now we have an annual work program. So this 2020 work program is not only approved for community planning, it's also approved for public works. So Rob is going to go over what the council approved that is on the list for public works to do. Okay. And the way that this is structured, I'm not going to go into details, but I'll have to really say that some of the work that we do is mandatory. What I mean by that is we are one of the counties planning on the GMS. So as a result, what we do is mandated through RCW. Of course, there are some of the RCW that we have to follow in doing our work. There are certain things that are ongoing, just like the Planning Commission. You don't have a break. So we are one of the commission that you're one of the commission that we are responsible for. So your work is ongoing. You can see number one item there that the Planning Commission or all the commissions that we have are all ongoing, and it is mandatory through RCW 3563. And it is a joint meeting when we come to you. Sometimes we have transportation-related issues or land use related issues. The other, someone has to come and help your boss here. So, I'm trying to go up.
Did you break it?
No, I didn't break it. I'm trying to just go up.
Did you break it?
Well, no, I didn't.
That's not the
problem. All broken.
Are you going?
No.
Can you roll?
No.
Just go.
So we have the Historical Commission. That is also ongoing. We are responsible for that. And Jackie, who just stepped out, is responsible for that program. And you can see the National Historic Preservation Act dating back to 1966. We have also RCW 2734-200 and the USC Code. That is what enables us to do the historical preservation program. We have the Shoreline Master Program that's also ongoing. You can see all the RCWs that mandates that we do that. You're going to be seeing the periodic update of the shoreline coming to you sometime in March, and then over to your recommendation will be forwarded on to council. We are obligated by statute to complete that by June 2020. Okay, so Jenna is going to be coming to you sometime in March. Jose just talked briefly about the buildable lands program and monitoring. I put it on here because that is also required by statute. The first time that program come into existence is known as RCW 3678-215. That was the first time GMA was amended to add the buildable lands program. Since then, the timeline that Jose shared with you a minute ago was as a result of another bill that the legislature went through and passed. It's known as 5254. That's what provided the timeline which Clark County has to complete our buildable lands before we do our next periodic review. We do our coordination and planning with all the seven cities in the county, and also now with the tribe, we do reach out to them. So that is required under 3678-110. It's also a joint program between land use and transportation. Some of you may recall that we came to the Planning Commission to do a circulation plan where we have an issue with access with the folks that live north of the tribe where their land was taken into reservation. So we work with Public Works and the tribe to reach a consensus of what that transportation issue should be. We also have a school advisory council. Of course, we have the Commission on Aging. So those are ongoing commissions, and we are responsible for. On the land use side, you know, this is one area where we have no control. when, after the adoption of the plan, if it's appealed, we spend time with the PA's office trying to respond to those appeals. So it's always ongoing. Our current 2016 comp plan is still under appeal. I will say that we are coming very close in coming into compliance. I don't know whether Chris has anything to add, but we are hopeful that, I know Rob, who is sitting next to me here, would like to see us come into compliance so that they will be able to be applying for available grants. So that's really, we are hoping. If not, what I can say is that we have additional compliance hearing, or one last one, hopefully. That is scheduled for March 4th. So we are hoping that we will be successful. I'll just leave it at that.
So just to add to that, one of my, under the umbrella of what I'm responsible for is our transportation improvement program, along with obtaining grants to build capital projects of various types around the county. And we like it when the county's in compliance, because that means we have the whole host of grants available for local, state, and federal. And if we're not in compliance, we have a very serious risk of losing the ability to get grants and funding sources. So it's a good thing when we're in compliance. We like that.
Well, we're not there yet.
Yep.
I know, but we still like it when we're in compliance.
Yes. It's
so, I'm sure you have the memory of it.
Yes. I'm hoping that this appeal will not last long. The last one took us 7 years to come into compliance. My goal is always to do whatever we can to come into compliance every time that we have an appeal. So we are working diligently with the PA's office to see if we can come into compliance. Like I said, word from the growth board is that we have another compliance hearing coming up in March 4th. That's all I can add. Hopefully, following that, I don't know when their ruling will come out, but I'm hoping that they will find us in compliance. I'm crossing my fingers. We talked about the buildable lands. That's due, again, June of 2021, required by Section 215 and the amended the new bill 5254 I just spoke about. We are also responsible for any time that the gorge goes through. This is the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Management Plan. You can see that it is mandatory that we, because there's a portion of the gorge that is in Clark County, so anytime that they update their code, we are required as one of the counties to also go through the gorge code and amend that. Hopefully we'll do a good job amending that so that we don't have any, the same issue we had last time, whether we had a Scrivener error or whatever it is, but we will pay attention because it's going to be a code work again. So I will work hard with my staff to make sure that's done. I spoke briefly about the Shoreline Master Program. We are in the process of completing the periodic update on that. Again, it's due June 20th, 2020, actually June 30th, 2020. Okay, stop there. The coordinated water system plan is another project that is in my shop. We are looking at updating that sometime in February of this year. I'm not sure whether we'll be on, we'll meet that deadline, but this is a project that is not originated from my shop. It comprises all the public works throughout the county, cities. So this is required. You can see all the work, but it's done every 5 years. So we're anticipating working with all the public works staff and seeing if we can meet that deadline. If not, then we'll push it to sometime in March. It's a five-year update, so if we finish it this year, we will still be within that five-year time frame to get it completed.
Is it this year or next year? It says
2021. 2021, yeah, but I'm pushing hard. We started this last year.
Oh.
I'm still waiting on them, yeah.
Oh,
there's
okay.
Some issues that we really want to get through. The City of Woodland have made a request that we amend our countywide planning policy to include them in the broader planning for when we do a periodic review. The Cowles is not yet planning under GMA, but very soon they will. The City of Woodland opted to plan under the GMA, so they're one of the 7 or 8 cities that we are planning with. One of the first things we have to do is amend what is called our countywide planning policy and then include them, and through that process, they will be participating with us. Currently, in my coordination with cities, they come to the meeting, so they're on top of what we are doing, and we're on top of what they're doing as well. One of the areas that they are very interested in, can they, the City of Woodland, expand into Clark County? Through that countywide planning policy, we will come up with how that is going to be done, because there is no part of, only very small part of Woodland or Clark County is in Woodland, and that's the Horseshoe Lake area. So amendment to our countywide planning policy would give us opportunity to coordinate much better, following a written policy that everybody agrees to. So that's one of these efforts coming to you sometime next year. Of course, the Cowles tribe property have been taken into trust. Right now, it's showing as ag on our comp plan. We would like to amend that and recognize that that property has been taken into trust. We don't want to continue to show it as ag designated property. There are some other areas where we need to coordinate with them. I mentioned transportation. There may be other areas that is above my pay grade when it comes to law enforcement and other things that the county will probably dialogue with the tribe to get into MOU with. So that's not my area. You're going to hear more about innovative housing, so I'm not going to go in depth about that. What you see on the mandatory section is all the recent house bill that we have to attend to see what Clark County needs to do to comply with those newly adopted bills, if you will. I'm just going to go through this quickly. Annual reviews, these are what you see every year. Sometimes we get 2, 3, 4. In addition to that, we do the docket program. These are county-initiated changes to text, to code. Sometimes annual reviews that the council asks us to do as a docket or as a freebie. You see that every year, so you're going to be seeing the 2020 before you, Sharon here is the project manager on our annual reviews and dockets. So it's a joint effort between planning and transportation. The other thing that you will see soon is hemp. Just like you dealt with the marijuana ordinance, hemp is one that the federal government is now delisting. And the state of Washington is beginning to put new rules in place on how to manage that. There may be some folks who may be licensed to grow it because the THC level is much, much lower than marijuana. So as soon as the new rules come into play, we are going to be working with you and the council to determine what areas would the council, the county allow hemp to grow. So that's something that we are going to be coming to you when the council is asking us to move forward on it, so we are going to be having some kind of a work session and then coming to you for, depending on the direction from council. I don't know, let me just stop there. You're looking like you have a question, sir.
Oh, I see August of 2020. seems like, is that when you're wanting to complete that by?
Yes.
That's what it says.
It could slip, but I think I would say this year. Okay?
And so this is talking about regular outdoor, like in a field, not like growing inside in a controlled grow room.
We don't know yet. It could be both.
Does it grow in our climate? I guess that would be the question.
Some people said, yeah, it could grow indoor or outdoor. So
okay.
Right now...
And this is the industrial, like for... rope and other fibers and things.
Yes, we're going to be having that conversation. Should it be in the light industrial zone? Should it be in the area that we zone ag? The way that the state is defined.
No, I meant it's an industrial product. It's
yes.
not for personal recreational use.
Exactly.
It's to create
so,
things.
Workers.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know.
Does that THC?
It's my understanding that there are about how many? Six? Six license holders now in Clark County. Yeah, so the reason that there is a license is because of the THC level that needs to be carefully managed. Of course, you're going to see some amendment as needed on Title 40. We are looking at every time that FEMA makes changes to the FEMA map, we come before you to make that change. It is very helpful to those that are on the floodplain and helped in insurance rate and so forth. So that's that on FEMA. There are some schools district, this come before you, there are some school district that are proposing to amend their capital facilities plan and the associated school impact fees. So you're going to be seeing that in 2020 because the action which you, Sharon is going to go through shortly, the 2019 annual reviews and docket was finally adopted in February. So our new cycle begins in February. So this is why we say February 2021. So you're going to see that part of that is going to be any changes made to the countywide planning policy is going to be part of that that will come through next time. So it looks like I'm coming closer to turn it over to Rob. Okay. some of this now I will turn over to Rob. I think we're beginning with bike and pet. So this is all yours, sir.
Good evening. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Rob Klugan, the Transportation Division Manager. And
might be a bit better.
Thank you. I'll see if I can work it. And I'll tell you, being the Transportation Division Manager sounds a lot more glamorous than it actually is. I'm trying to start out with a joke. I was hoping that Gary gets some sort of response.
It is glamorous.
So we recently, at the beginning of this year, last year, time goes by fast, brought the transportation planners up into the transportation division so that they're a part of the larger group of traffic engineers and all the operations people we have for signs, signals, and markings. And so we have a really good connection now between the planning and engineering that we had a separation before that worked, and putting them together, we're finding it's going to work better. We have a number of things on the docket. The Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, I'm sure you've seen before, it's a continuation of an ongoing program to provide the support for meeting with people that are very vested in the bicycle and pedestrian mode and making sure that we're having them review and look at what we're doing to make sure that we're consistent with the needs of the community. Developers agreements, as I'm sure most of you are aware, we used to do a developers agreements ad hoc, and now developers agreements will be a start of following a specific county code policy, but we'll be very involved in those developer agreements. We have a few that are still running forward on an ad hoc basis, but we're starting to push the developers towards a standardized process that follows a county code. Any modifications to the arterial atlas would be part of what we would do, and adding projects to the capital facilities program. in the plan program. The CFP is a part of the comprehensive plan that looks at what we need for the 20-year horizon for the transportation needs associated with the growth of ongoing growth of land use that occurs. And so there will be changes coming to the arterial atlas as every year where things are changed. Within that, I apologize, I'm going to just look real quick to see if it's on here. Okay, so I'll talk about that later. I'll come back to the capital facilities plan and the arterial atlas. We will also be undertaking circulation plans. One of the things that we're very interested in taking a look at is as we continue to develop the 179th Street corridor and new capital projects are put in there, we're going to put a very significant amount of public and private dollars into building that corridor for the capacity that's needed for the land use that will be coming. And we're going to be very interested to make sure that we preserve as much of that capacity as possible and not have a driveway every 50 feet on a 45-mile-an-hour principal arterial. So how are we going to facilitate the existing arterial atlas and then flesh that out and make it better for preserving the capacity and the investment on the building of the infrastructure? And we're looking at other locations to add those into. Similar idea with the neighborhood plans. One of the things that we're interested in taking a look at is we need to make connections for pedestrian access and also vehicle access through neighborhoods to be able to provide relief at certain locations and to provide opportunities for people to make a movement across locations. And I'm a traffic engineer by training. I'm a civil engineer by training. I was the traffic signal guy for the county for a very long time. But one of my passions is not signals. I don't live and breathe signals, even though that's what I did for 10 years. I'm very interested in finding ways to improve how our system works for all users of the system so we're not just building a road along an area and then not connecting it to neighborhoods. We need to have the connections for pedestrian bicycles and vehicles from that new road we're building to the neighborhood so people have the ability to get from the neighborhood safely onto the roads and also crossing those roads. And so there's a lot of things in the background that are going on that we'll be coming forward and talking with you and others about as we move forward over the next couple of years. Traffic impact fees are part of what we do. We take information and provide it to the council and commissions like yourself, developer, DEEB board, et cetera, and try to find a way to fund our projects based upon the needs of the development and ongoing growth. This is really interesting.
I know.
So I've kind of babbled about a couple of things here, and normally I would have liked to have started out with a transportation system plan and worked down. Clark County has never had a transportation system plan. It's not required in the state of Washington. It is something that is a requirement for the state of Oregon. And we're borrowing the concept for the state of Oregon and kind of morphing a little bit to help us do a better job from a transportation perspective. Right now what we have is we have the code, comprehensive plan, arterial atlas, CFP, at a very high level as a policy level. And we have all of our individual programs, but there isn't a direct connection between the two. So the transportation system plan is something that's going to sit between the high-level policy documents and the day-to-day applications to be able to allow that linkage and connection to understand how the different programs are going to work with each other and also provide consistency of application so that when somebody comes in either for a development, they're getting consistently applied regardless of who the engineer is, or something as literally simple as making sure that we're putting the same size signs out there and one engineer thinks you should put a 48-inch sign and the other engineer says we should put a 36-inch sign. But there's a lot of elements that go into that transportation system plan as an overarching document that's not intended to be prescriptive. It's intended to provide the connection for the policymakers to let us do our jobs at the program level as we build programs such as a neighborhood traffic transportation neighborhood traffic plan. We have not done any form of traffic calming in our county for as long as I've been here, and next Tuesday it'll be 18 years that I've been at the county. That may or may not be the right choice, but we need to take a look at what the costs of that are going to be and have the conversation with the elected officials and say, do we want to change that? We have other things like an active transportation plan, which is a concept of not needing to be in your single occupant vehicle to go from where you live to where you want to go, how we're going to stitch together programs and systems so that we can turn around and allow for you and every other person to have viable options for non-single occupant vehicles to walk, bike, bus, combinations of trips to get from where you go, come from and go to. Other aspects that are going to fall under the transportation system plan are programs where we are going to be, the ADA transition plan will be part of that. So we're currently working on developing an ADA transition plan, which will be coming in front of you. The TSP will be coming in front of you also. But the ADA transition plan to look at how we're going to spend the money that we have to resolve the fact that we have intersections and curb ramps and sidewalks that need to be replaced, repaired, or installed to allow for the transportation system to work for all users. And when I'm up here talking about users of the transportation system, that is everyone from a person not in a vehicle, a person in a wheelchair, walker, pedestrian, all the way through to a truck and everything in between. So I'm not a traditional traffic engineer that thinks about cars. I think about the system, and I'm very interested in how we can move that system forward. One of the other things that will be very interesting is we're starting to put roundabouts in corridors. Clark County built our first roundabout at the intersection of 10th Avenue and 136th Street about 10 years ago. And as the signal guy who was responsible for all the stuff that was going on in the Salmon Creek Interchange Project and all the signals, we sited the roundabout there because it was the right thing to do. It was the right tool to put in the intersection. And so we're looking at other locations where, because of the way roundabouts work, we can reduce the potential for high-speed T-bone collisions and high-speed accidents, because the roundabouts are safer for almost every single use case that we can look at, that we have looked at. So part of being able to put a roundabout in is that the requirements for the right-of-way at the intersections are different. The corridor thought process is different. Because if you put a roundabout corridor in, such as on 137th Avenue in the city of Vancouver, they were able to narrow up the road and reduce the impact on all the adjacent property owners by putting a median in, making all the driveways right in, right out, and go U-turns through the nearby roundabouts instead of having to have a much wider road with a center turn lane. But in order to do that, we have to have some vision to say, what are our county code, what's the county code going to say, so that everyone is treated properly when they come in for development and we reserve the right-of-way for future roundabouts. Where are we planning on putting the roundabouts? What is the roundabout corridor going to look like? How is the arterial atlas going to show what those roundabouts are? And so all of this is stuff we're looking at starting this year, and we'll be coming back and talking with you and Deeb and others and saying, are we doing this right? What perspective do you have on it? And there's always people that like roundabouts, and there's always people that do not like roundabouts. And I'm sure in this group we're going to find a wide variety of spectrum.
So what's the cost implication of roundabouts?
So
just out of curiosity.
So a traffic signal, when you look at an intersection, it depends on a lot of things. Because if you have the intersection of 78th Street and Highway 99, for example, it's built out up to the edges. We have no way of widening that out. If we were to take that and do something different than what's there and put a roundabout there, it would be stupidly expensive to do, because you'd have to buy out businesses on all four corners and a lot more. When you take an area such as the intersection where we're planning to put a roundabout in, we have grant funding to pursue the design and construction at 119th Street and 152nd Avenue. The cost for us to go through and demolish the existing signal and put in a roundabout, single lane roundabout, or a fully signalized intersection with left turn lanes and all the things we need to do are actually about a wash. The ongoing maintenance is lower for a roundabout, but the key with a roundabout is that what you have with a traffic signal is you have the potential for a high-speed T-bone collision, which has a very high likelihood of being fatal or very, very injurious. With a roundabout, what you have is you have a situation where typically the worst type of accident happens is one vehicle's in the roundabout, the other one doesn't yield, and you have a sideswipe accident that has much lower speeds, much lower kinetic energy, and you have a situation where you're going to have body damage to the cars as opposed to a horrific end result, generally. Now, there are videos on the internet of people that don't understand you're supposed to slow down, and they you see them launch their cars in the roundabout. These things do happen.
Well, I would assume, though, on a new construction, a new road where you're putting them in, like the one on 10th and 136, I would think the cost would be less, right, as opposed to redesigning?
So in the case of 10th and 136, in order to put a signal there instead of a roundabout, we would have had to have bought the bank at 10th and Tenney.
Well, I'm saying a roundabout would be more cost-effective.
Right, but to put a signal there instead of the roundabout, when we did the cost analysis, we would have had to have enough right-of-way that we would have taken all of the driveway and all the drive aisle and a bunch of the parking for the bank, yep. Which meant we would have purchased a bank at $2 million.
Gotcha.
Which is not necessarily a good thing, but the roundabout was something that worked really well. We're actually in a process right now on 179th Street at 50th Avenue and 29th Avenue, where we're looking as part of the 179th Street projects to say, should we put a roundabout at those two locations? Roundabouts, those two locations are signals. So we found the combination of intersection configurations for a multi-lane roundabout and for a traffic signal that would provide equal capacity. And now we're in the process of actually analyzing to say, if you drop a roundabout in here, what do we need for right-of-way? What do we need for impacts to wetlands and all the other things that go along with that versus what are the impacts and costs associated with putting a signal there and then making a decision, because both of the locations, either a signal or a roundabout would work. So we're actually having the cost drive the decision to say, to build a roundabout, you have to do all these things. To build a signal, you have to do all of those things. And which one is the greatest impact?
Go ahead. No. Is cost the only factor that you look at? Because there's a lot. I mean, even if it costs more to do a roundabout, sometimes it's for the greater good.
Correct.
I mean, because it just is.
You're right.
A lot better flow for traffic.
You're right.
I live in downtown Ridgefield. Yeah. I don't hit one stop sign.
So there's a continuum of traffic engineering solutions. One is the uncontrolled intersection in a neighborhood, all the way up to a full grade separated interchange. And what happens is, from the capacity needs of the intersection, signals work in a range of that, and roundabouts work in another range. It typically has a little less total capacity. And so there are situations where a roundabout just will not work because the combination of movements fight against each other so badly that you can't make it work. For example, we looked at a multi-lane roundabout at the intersection of 72nd Avenue. I apologize, I'm going way off topic, but... 72nd Avenue and 119th Street when we built 119th Street. And what we found was the morning traffic, with the traffic coming from Battleground south on 72nd Avenue, plus the traffic that was going westbound turning left, actually caused the roundabout to fail. We could not build that combination to work because there weren't gaps for the westbound left turning traffic with all the southbound traffic. So a signal was the solution there, even though it would have been nice to put a roundabout there. So we do a lot of analysis to try to find out, is there a way we can do the least impactive and probably the safest and best solution, which quite likely will be a roundabout. Now, the second part of the question is, if we were talking about 78th Street between 30th Avenue and Highway 99, if we're going to drop a new major intersection in there, it may not make sense to drop a roundabout in the middle of a whole bunch of traffic signals. So that may drive an answer in another direction. But you're right. For the most part, roundabouts are a really good solution, and we would look at them very, very carefully to make sure that that was something we really could do before we would look at something else. So I think I beat to death number two. Number three is capital project system scoping. What we want to start doing and what we are starting to do is take a look at the projects that are on the TIP, the Transportation Improvement Program, in the six-year horizon and start to actually do a very preliminary design so we understand what the impacts are, as opposed to, well, we're drawing a line from this point to this point, it's 3.2 miles, and so therefore it's going to be $18 million. So we want to take a look at what the options are. And so for an example, on 72nd Avenue, there's a project coming up on the TIP to determine what we're going to do for 72nd Avenue between 219th Street all the way down to 119th Street. It's like a five-mile section. So we're looking at, given what we know about what's happening in the next 20 years, do we need to build a full road section that whole way to make it work? Can we apply a concept such as skinny roads, fat nodes, which allows for narrowing the roads down between the intersections and then building a large intersection where people would diverge and then merge on the other side? And will it work with roundabouts, multi-lane roundabouts, or will it work only with signals based upon what we're looking at? So rather than just draw that line and say, we'll get to it when we get to it, we're trying to do that pre-scoping as we put it on the TIP. The next step is to go onto the CFP and have a better idea of what we're going to be building in the CFP so that we have a better way of getting to the point that we can start projects. And one of the things that's driving this is that many of our funding agencies are requiring that we put in, that we, when we submit an application for a grant, we have a 30% design complete. So we're not able to apply for some grants because we've been a little too, we haven't done enough detailed work. So we're trying to react to that and get to the point that we have a much better idea that when we go for the grants, we're ready to be, to move forward. So try to finish up here quickly because I've been talking a lot. We have a parks plan, a PROS plan that we're going to be working on. That's a requirement. We're not actually directly working on that. This is something the parks are working on, but we will be facilitating and working with them on. And I believe these are yours.
These are what I will call projects that are deferred. They've been on the radar. Some of you are aware of number two, and we started that project. We completed the phase, which came to the Planning Commission and was approved. We started the second phase and got to a point where it is now on hold. On hold because of some legal issues that I'm not privy to talk about because some of it is in litigation. All I can say is that we will pick that up whenever we can and bring it back to the Planning Commission and then back to Council for action. The Ag economic assessment, that is one thing that the council had wanted to do, but then for some reason it's on hold. It started out as potentially doing an ag-wide or area-wide ag assessment, but it turned into perhaps doing an assessment of the agricultural economy in Clark County, and again, that is on hold at the request of the council, not staff. The Capital Facilities Financial Plan, that is really the plan that specify how we pay for some of these capital projects. So that also, we will be coming back to that as soon as we know what we need to update. The reason it's on hold, some of you are aware that the county is looking at, for example, the jail. That's a really major undertaking. when decision on that is made, it will go into the capital facilities financial plan on how to fund that and so forth. If it goes to the vote of the people, we will put all of that cost. Right now, the county is looking at doing an RFP on the design and so forth. So that's why this project is on hold. The last thing I will say is that you see the date, some of them are 2021, 2022, but this is approved work program for us to begin to do the work and then come to you in a form of an update. When we are ready to go to a hearing, we'll come to a hearing, but we are beginning to work on some of this. Okay. Thank you. I'm here to answer questions. You got a lot on your plate.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question, just a clarity question on the comp plan appeal process. Rob, you said something about the at risk. Is that at risk in terms of the application process, or is it at risk in terms of grants if you already have?
So I don't think, if I said at risk, what I meant to say was there are projects that we have that can have a variety of state, local, and federal grants and funding sources. As long as we are out of compliance, some of those are not available to us. And so it's a fact, and so it limits our ability to go after some of the colors of money that we can use to be able to build the projects to move forward. Not all of them, just a small handful of them.
So the ability to apply for certain grants.
Yes, sir.
And then the other question I would have, and maybe this is more of a Chris question, it sounds like then there is some meeting that's happening in March. And then if that fails, then what happens after that?
Oh, you're speaking of a hearing in March. Well, the county has been ruled non-compliant and invalid now for going on 3 years. So if the county doesn't win in March, nothing will happen. It will continue in the same dismal status.
And so just kind of a forecast in terms of our ability to get into compliance? What's the impediment?
Yeah, the county has done everything it can do.
Okay.
The Rural Industrial Land Bank has been eliminated in terms of designation and in terms of code provisions that would have implemented it. So that doesn't exist anymore. So the county is in compliance with regard to that issue. The county has successfully appealed to the Court of Appeals on the urban growth boundary expansions. The Court of Appeals ruled those expansions moot. Both sides, Clark County Citizens United and FutureWise, took that to the Supreme Court, which refused to hear their petition. So the Supreme Court informed the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals issued a mandate to the Growth Board. The Growth Board, in my view, should have ruled that the county is now compliant. However, they decided that they would like to hear briefing from us and from FutureWise on a bit of an issue that they claim is still live. I think that is just 100% wrong. The issue was issue 5 in the appeal, which said that expanding the urban growth boundaries was improper because there was sufficient capacity within the urban growth boundaries and because the county had not taken reasonable measures to increase density. What FutureWise has suggested and the Growth Board wants us to brief is the question of reasonable measures see it. That's not the issue. The word because was before there. The question is, did the county improperly expand urban growth boundaries because reasonable measures had been taken? The court has ruled that the issues regarding urban growth boundary expansions are moot and that the growth board has no authority to rule on them. So, much to my dismay, I received a communication from the growth board last week telling me that I had less than 2 weeks to get briefing to them on the question of whether the county is in compliance on reasonable measures. And FutureWise has not argued its case on paper, so they haven't submitted a brief that argues this. So we don't even know what they're going to say. We kind of have to brief. We have to respond to their complaints without knowing exactly what their complaints are. This is, if I seem like I'm in a bad mood, there's a reason.
We all know.
Okay.
So
that happens when you have non-lawyers running a board and trying to interpret a court of appeals case.
She is not.
Be careful what you ask.
That's what Brett.
And it moved. I haven't followed the case. I assume it's moved because the city's annexed, so there's nothing for it. We don't have any jurisdiction.
Right, and we are talking about the cities of La Santa and Richfield. That's all.
Just to be clear, when we're talking about colors of money and grant sources, one of the colors of money or sources of money is called the Public Works Trust Fund. And the Public Works Trust that we're not able to apply for because of the being out of compliance with the GMA. What the Public Works Trust Fund is, it's not really a grant. It's an opportunity to have a very lowest interest loan that we can use to leverage other projects and move things forward. So it's kind of like using your credit card, but it's like with a 1 or 1.5% interest typically. And so it allows us to do things where we know things are coming and we can build a project and get ahead of some things because we can get a relatively large opportunity for funding to be able to pay back over time at a very low interest rate. That's one of the funding sources that we're not able to tap at this point.
Yeah, Rob is correct. For my own, and I would say that I've been lucky so far because there are some grants that are not related to the public trust fund that I may not be able to apply for if they really want to say you can because you're out of compliance. A good example is this buildable lands work that we are doing, all the amendment to the shoreline that we are doing. I don't want to say that out loud. I know that in some program in public works, particularly the, stormwater.
Yeah, there's a couple of stormwater grants that it would be really nice if we would be in compliance by the end of March.
Yes.
And if we aren't, I don't know that that money will be available.
Right. So there are some other grants that, and to take it to the stream, the governor can impose sanctions if he so chooses. That really happens. So there are consequences for being out of compliance. So that's all we have. Stay tuned.
Thanks. Thank you.
Whoops.
Hi, my name is Sharon from Bontobing, and Oliver and Rob gave you a look forward to this year. I'm going to give you a quick look back at, we've never really come back to you and said how the council voted after you forwarded your planning commission recommendation, so this is a very quick look back, and they agreed with all of your recommendations. These are the annual reviews. These are the site-specific property owner requests to amend the comprehensive plan and zoning designations. With one exception, on Northeast 152nd, you had forwarded a recommendation of approval. This was a commercial to urban low, and they initially denied it, but then the applicant revised their proposal and went back to council on the 21st of January, and they proposed to leave this portion commercial and then just change this portion to urban low, and the council approved that. So that's kind of how that turned out.
First, council approved their motion for reconsideration. That's how it got there.
And then these were all the docket items that you had recommended approval, and the council agreed and approved these. With the exception of the school impact fees for Ridgefield, these were done in two tiers, one for 2020 and one for 2021, and they approved the 2020 school impact fees. They're going to come back around to you with their capital facilities plan and school impact fees. So that's going to come back. So that's how it turned out. That's all I got.
Well, I appreciate that. It's nice to kind of see how things turned out.
I appreciate that. Took you 1 minute.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Nice.
But I would like to talk more about roundabouts. If we can.
No.
I did have one more.
Can I ask you more about being in compliance?
No. Ooh.
Hello, I'm Jackie. Jenna and I are working on a new project regarding housing in the urban area. So we kind of wanted to give you an overview because you're going to be hearing about it throughout the next couple of years. So to kind of start you off, we gave a similar presentation to council in the fall to kind of, they requested to start looking at different ways that we could provide more housing options related to, you know, the affordability issues, and they've done some things in the past couple of years that you all have seen, so I'm going to kind of go over there. So we've kind of been going along this path of trying to look at different options. So we're just going to kind of go over what we've learned or what we know so far and what we want to learn more about and our next steps for this project. So just quick overview of what we're going to cover today. I'll try to be as brief as possible. So of course, as we are a county that plans under GMA for any project that we are going to work on related to land use, we always have to take in mind what those GMA required elements are, and we kind of pulled out the kind of three specific ones that probably relate to housing. So those will always be in our mind as we move forward with proposals for changes to policies and code or land use changes. So trying to figure out kind of what the issues are that are happening related to housing. We're trying to get our heads around what some of the emerging trends are. And since we didn't have anything kind of locally based as of yet, we kind of did some research at the state level or nationally of what's happening. So the state has done some recent housing research. They put out a housing memorandum saying that the state's having rapid economic and population growth over the last 10 years, which has led to significant housing demand and rising rents and prices. So while demand has surged, housing supply is low. Both rents and home prices has risen, of course, because of this. So, and to try to understand what's happening or what the current trends are nationally, the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University, they published their annual State of the Nation's Housing. It was in July. So we used some of that to kind of see what was going on. They did have some metro or countywide data to kind of see what was happening in our region. So what we, kind of the four things here that are kind of contributing or seeing the trends. One has to do with supply. So nationally, the vacancy rate for both owner-occupied and rental units fell in 2018 to 4.4%, its lowest point since 94. So several factors may be contributing to this unusually slow construction recovery. So they've kind of done some research to see what's going on nationwide. So some of their factors that they've come across have to do with possibly the housing boom in 2000s created a excess supply of homes and took most of the following decade to fill, to work off that surplus. So builders and lenders could be wary of speculative development that would expand the supply too quickly. So this was a nationally kind of looking. Labor shortages. So the residential construction sector has struggled to fill job openings. With economy near full employment, competition for workers has intensified, so limiting the ability of construction sector to ramp up quickly. The higher end market, so housing being built is intended primarily for the higher end market, and so the lack of smaller and more affordable new homes suggests that the rising cost of labor, land, and materials make it unprofitable to build for the middle market. So restricting the land supply of land available for different types of housing may add to that challenge of supplying more affordable types of housing. Regarding affordability, so you all are probably familiar with it, the ratio of the median home price to median household income is used to measure affordability, indicating how difficult it would be for would-be buyers to qualify for a mortgage and save for a down payment. So nationwide, this ratio rose sharply from a low of 3.3 in 2011 to 4.1 in 2018. But conditions are different throughout the country, with home values more than five times the incomes in areas of the West Coast, including the Portland, Vancouver, Hillsboro metro area. So we're on the high end nationally. Low and falling vacancy rents are vacancy rates are also keeping the pressure on rents. So this tightness reflects substantial drops in the supply of low-cost units as markets rents climbed. So location, for most households, transportation is the second largest annual expenditure after housing. The increasing disconnect between job location and housing supply places a greater demand on our transportation system and causes a greater proportion of time and income to be spent on commuting. Considering location and transportation accessibility and selecting sites for housing that is affordable to a variety of income levels can help create better connected communities. And then lastly, all stages of life, right? Over the next decade, two generations will dominate population growth, the millennials and the boomers. So under these assumptions, the aging baby boomers will add some 8.4 million households nationally that are either going to be single persons or married without children households. While this surge in one- and two-person households might imply strong demand for smaller homes, as we have learned and we staff the Commission on Aging, a lot of older adults want to age in place or remain in their current homes as they age. But even if this large age group does not choose to relocate, demand for smaller, more accessible homes is going to increase. With the 35 to 44-year-old group, nearly two-thirds of the growth in households over the next 10 years will be among families with children. Given high homeownership rates at this stage of life, demand for owner-occupied housing is projected to grow substantially over the decade. Since many will be first-time buyers, the demand for those entry-level homes should be especially strong. But today's relatively low homeownership rates for this age group also imply continuing demand for rentals. There we go. So in the summary, the report concluded, you can read it with me here, with the economy on sound footing and incomes ticking up, household growth has finally returned to a more normal pace. Housing production, however, has not. The shortfall in new homes is keeping the pressure on house prices and rents, eroding affordability, particularly for modest income households in high-cost markets, which is kind of what we got going on. While demographic trends should support a vibrant housing market over the coming decade, realizing this potential depends heavily on whether the market can provide a broader and more affordable range of housing options for tomorrow's households. So kind of leads us into what we're working on. To give you kind of a snapshot of Clark County, this shows that in 2017, the county had about 176,422 housing units, and you can see kind of the breakdown on the number, the percentage of single family versus multifamily versus the mobile manufactured, and then housing tenure, the percentage of renters versus owners, just kind of as understanding kind of where we are. This slide kind of shows the housing affordability kind of snapshot. And of course, we're working on, you know, census data. So, you know, soon we'll, in a year or so, we'll have the newest one. But this is using median household income according to the American Community Survey 2017. So this shows that the county's median household income was $67,000. And that the median sale price of a home in Clark County in July of 2019 was $369,000. So plugging these figures into one of those online affordability calculators, I use Zillow's for this example, indicates that a person making that salary could afford a house up to $288,000, which if you're looking around, that's hard to come by. Census data further indicates that 30% of county households are cost burden, so that those are spending 30% of income on housing. And you can see the split between the renters and owners there that are cost burden. Additionally, there's an index, the Center for Neighborhood Technology provides a housing and transportation index and shows that 52% of Clark County households are spending over 45% of their income on housing and transportation costs. And then additionally, recently there was an article in the Columbian. They have done the point in time count, the homelessness count for 2019. And I believe in that article it said that we've seen a 21% increase since last year of those that are that were counted. So to kind of see where we've been, the county has been trying to work on looking at housing and what we have available in our code to provide additional types of housing. In 2018, and you all saw this as the Planning Commission, the council adopted changes to the development code to support more diversity in housing choices and to try to promote more housing affordability. So we made some changes to the accessory dwelling units code, so removing the bedroom restrictions that were in place, allowing full basement ADU, the minimum square footage, removing the minimum lot size of 5,000 square foot. We adopted a 75% reduction in impact fees to encourage it, remove the owner occupancy requirement, and then in the rural area, allowing attached ADUs as an option. For cottage, we did some things to cottage housing, so to hopefully to get some more of that type of development, reducing the minimum size from 500 square foot to 150 square feet. For manufactured housing, we made some revisions or amendments to the code as well to hopefully clarify some things and to allow more flexibility there. Tiny homes as well. We amended the single family dwelling definition to include tiny homes so that they could be built. They can be used as ADUs, single family homes, or as part of a cottage housing development. And just we were trying to provide just kind of things that were happening to date. Every year, Community Services has to put together a consolidated annual performance and evaluation report for our federal funding that we receive for community development block grants. So they had provided the update last year for council, and this is the kind of the success of what was constructed through those funding programs, as well as the council took advantage of one of the recent housing bills that came out from the state to impose a sales and use tax credited against the state sales and use tax for purposes of affordable and supportive housing. And also, I made a note, something the City of Vancouver has done, they're allowing affordable housing with specific criteria in most of their commercial zones, which is a new thing that they're going to try to see to try to encourage that to be developed, or at least get rid of that barrier. Yeah, and the county is interested in looking at that as well. So we'll be coming back and talking more about that. So as we take stock of the work that we've accomplished, that the county has done and tried to work on to date, we want to see are there other barriers and opportunities to provide more variety of housing types for all income levels. So we know that zoning dictates determines how communities are designed, developed, and built. The last time the county's urban residential zones were reviewed and analyzed was with the adoption of our 94 plan, which was when GMA was adopted. So with the changing market and the need of today's households, as we've learned from kind of those emerging trends, we think it's good to take kind of another look at what we have and see if there's any opportunities there. So the Vancouver urban growth area has a large urban population. So Clark County is pretty unique in that they have that under their jurisdiction, and urban almost as large as the City of Vancouver in population. The yellow that you see within the black outline, so that's of course the urban growth boundary, shows the land that is under one of the five single family zoning districts. So all that yellow is specific single family zoning. So although the changes made in the first phase of this project allow for more flexibility for alternative housing types such as the ADUs and the cottage housing, the council wants to see if there's additional opportunities to encourage even more varieties of housing than just single family, where it's appropriate and where it makes sense. So like areas that are close to transit would be, you know, something that comes to mind. Another example where a review and analysis of our zoning could be helpful in assessing barriers and providing different types besides single family is that currently you can build single family homes in our median density multifamily districts, which then decreases those opportunities for being able to build that type. So we're shrinking the opportunities when we have that being built in our median density. This one, as you can see in this graphic, this subdivision is adjacent to Phillida Elementary. It's zoned R12, which we define as medium, and it appears from looking at the property online that it's fairly large single family home. So I'm going to turn it over to Jenna to kind of share kind of where we are now and what the this new project is going to entail. Council has given us direction to move forward with this, and we have two of them as liaisons for this project. So we'll be working together on things that make sense for the county and working with a bunch of stakeholders, which will include you. And I'll let Jenna kind of explain that scope.
All right. So we put out an RFP at the beginning of this year. And we just want to talk about what was in it. The idea, we're calling this project the Housing Option Study and Action Plan. And the main purpose is to understand our local housing challenges and identify opportunities to encourage construction of additional housing that is affordable to low, moderate, and middle income households within the unincorporated Vancouver urban growth area. Through the removal of regulatory barriers and or other implementation strategies. And the project is going to involve, we have a staff team, Jackie's going to be our project manager, We put out an RFP because we are interested in bringing some consultants on board to help us with the work. We plan on developing an advisory group that's going to help us figure out what to do. And then also pretty extensive public involvement for anyone who wants to be involved. And then meetings with you all and the council are also within that scope as well. And so the idea is to start with stakeholder interviews and an issue assessment. So we thought rather than jumping right into forming an advisory group and pushing forward that we really wanted to hear from folks from a variety of perspectives to really be able to map out what people are seeing as barriers and potential opportunities so we can understand, you know, where are people pretty much in agreement, what are the things we're going to really need to dig into and sort out, and it'll help us plan the project and figure out, you know, who makes sense to be involved in the group that's going to be trying to figure out these recommendations. So we'll start with the interviews. The end result of those interviews will be a recommendation to council of interests to consider having representatives of those interests in the advisory group. Once council appoints folks, the advisory group will start to meet, and we'll be working with them, you know, then throughout the project moving forward, really looking for their input on helping inform the data collection piece and then the formulation of recommendations. So in terms of data collection, we really want to be able to paint a picture of the housing market, like specific and unincorporated Vancouver, you know, area in the county. So we want to look at data broader than that. You know, we want to look throughout the county and into the whole Portland metro area to see how we fit, you know, into that bigger picture. But want to make sure that we're sort of all operating from the same place in terms of, like, we know the prices are high, right? We know that, but what's going on in this one area in the county in terms of sales prices, rents, trends we're seeing, things like that. So our consultant team will be helping us, you know, aggregate a lot of data and hopefully make it digestible so that we can all sort of really dive into what's going on. We also are going to be doing a policy and regulatory review. And so that means, you know, reviewing our housing policies, zoning, and other development code, looking for, you know, what things are in there that are creating issues, right, that we might be able to address. And then also sort of as part of that policy and regulatory review is making sure we're reviewing all the state legislation that's passed recently and identifying things we have to do or other opportunities of things we could do that are coming through from the state. And I'm missing something else. And the one other thing related to that is we do also just want to take a look at some of the, there are a lot of jurisdictions who are sort of diving into this type of work or who've done it recently. And so making sure we're paying attention to what has happened elsewhere and are learning lessons, whether it's in terms of the ideas that people are proposing or if they did something in their process that, you know, where things ended up going haywire because they didn't have people on the same page, you know, as they worked through it or something like that. So just want to make sure we're learning from what others have done in this area. So then once we've sort of gone through the data collection, review of all of our policies and regulations, the project really is going to shift into development of recommendations on options for things that make sense here in Clark County. I don't think we know what that exactly looks like at this point. You know, it could be, again, it could be small adjustments in our code. It could be maybe we need to create a new zone. I mean, we don't know what's going to end up being recommended. And we have a bullet here about public involvement. We do have a plan to have, we don't want to just bring the public in at the end. You know, we want to have that going along, you know, at the same time as we're doing project advisory meetings so that we're hearing throughout the process from as many folks as we can. And then once we have recommendations, then we'll move into the legislative process with you all and the county council. So that's the scope of work. And then in terms of our project schedule, we actually were interviewing consultants today. So we are working on finalizing who our consultant is going to be, and then as quickly as possible starting the project once we have a contract set up. And then the idea is this spring that we'll work on our public participation plan, start those stakeholder interviews, get our advisory group formed, and that advisory group that would meet once or twice and provide just some initial input before we ask our consultants to go do a bunch of research and data collection. So they'd help shape and inform what that's going to look like. Then over the summer, our consultants would be doing a lot of that background research data piece. And then in the fall, we'd really start diving into the recommendations and developing those and doing a bunch of public outreach, and then next year wrapping things up and moving into adoption.
So our goal, if I may, is to have this project completed. At the same time, we are completing our buildable lands report. That one is due to the state. The goal there is to help inform the council and you on what type of changes could be made as we go into the periodic plan update. So that's really the goal. As both Jackie and Jenna indicated, we are excited about this project and happy that the council is providing us support. Again, we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but it's good to look into our current development regulations and our zoning. Again, this is not any project to increase density. This is to look at opportunities. Are there barriers, and if so, can it be identified and hopefully see a recommendation come out of that? That's really the goal. We don't have any known outcome, they say.
If I could just throw out, when you're doing your data collection, just I know you're going to hire a consultant or anything, but have you ever heard of a company called New Home Trends? That might be a company you might want to look into for some of that data collection that you're looking for here in Clark County. Okay. They're a very good source.
Great, so. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? More questions? Mm-hmm. Again, this is just an update on what we are working on. You know, and throughout the process, we will be doing check-ins, update. Hopefully, we'll have a planning commission member, hopefully sitting on the PAG. Like we said, there are two councillors, Councillor Blum and Councillor Olsen, who are volunteers to be on the group. Okay. So I'm excited about this, and I have a good team to work on it. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens. Yeah. The only thing I don't have is funding.
Anything else?
That's it.
Anything else
for
the order?
You might be seeing some title. I don't want to jump to the guard, but you might be seeing some title 40 code amendment coming your way as we get our last together. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Work your heart. A little housekeeping.